Cran versus Oswald. Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing Daniel Bertrand in this case. As Mr. Oswald pled this petition in district court, which was a mirror of his pleadings in the state court, he raised one claim that intertwined two separate arguments. The first was that the circuit court failed to do an adequate investigation when one of the veneer persons indicated that there was discussion of the case amongst the veneer in the assembly room.
Mr. Barnes, I need to ask you a procedural question, basically. You rest a lot of your argument on a comparison between the kinds of claims Mr. Oswald was presenting in the Wisconsin court and the way he presented the claim in the district court, but the record that has made it to this court on appeal does not include any of his motions in the Wisconsin trial court. It doesn't have his motion for post-conviction relief. It doesn't have the brief in support of the motion. It doesn't have all of these things. According to this court's records department, they were never made part of the district court record. So I don't see how you can rely on something and expect us to make an intelligent judgment about what exactly he did say and didn't say when we don't even have the material here.
Well, he raised a number of things in the circuit court that he didn't advance in the Court of Appeals.
That may be, but the point is, you are saying, because we're teasing out this distinction between investigating these issues of jury bias versus claiming that actually biased jurors were around, it's pretty hard to say that that's not pertinent to the federal habeas corpus petition. Forget about venue. I mean, I know there are other things that were off there in the case, and I certainly understand they're not before us. But
the Court of Appeals decision addressed all of the claims that he raised almost identically in the district court. So the comparison is between the Court of Appeals opinion and his petition
right, and
the district court's decision.
And if we look at the Court of Appeals opinion, it seems to me a fairly reasonable reading of that suggests that maybe the district court was using different paragraphs and so on, but he was addressing essentially the substance that the Wisconsin courts were looking at.
Well, when you look at the Court of Appeals decision, there the first part of the opinion is a specific claim of juror of the court trial court error in not granting challenges for cause for three jurors, none of whom sat on the jury. The second part of the opinion deals with this investigation, and the way Oswald brought the Mr. Schenke, which the district court relied on in a straight juror bias claim, was that was the prejudice he suffered from the failure of the circuit court to adequately investigate when one of the veneermen mentioned that things were going on and the discussions were going on in the assembly room. The second aspect was that Mr. Schenke, and he did clearly raise this in the state court, that Mr. Schenke gave incomplete or inaccurate, under Wisconsin law, incomplete answer is enough on Brewer Dyer. Even on the federal court, it has to be incorrect, as I understand it, or misleading. And he did raise that claim in state court. Again, in my view, that the reason he raised it that way was because until the post-conviction proceedings, he never objected to Schenke as being a biased jury, didn't challenge him for cause prior to trial.
Well, of course, how could he have?
You know, well, if his claim is correct,
the investigation was not. I mean, it's frankly shocking to me that the trial court judge here didn't allow some voir dire or some investigation of 29 people who had already been, you know, evaluated once so much evidence comes out that people in the jury room are talking about what a waste of time a trial is and so on and so forth. That in itself is really troublesome. Now, you can't really blame him for not investigating Schenke when he doesn't know that there's a problem.
That's true.
The Supreme Court has even made that clear. The Supreme Court has said those are the circumstances in which this earlier procedural action on the part of the defendant is excused. You can't say somebody wasn't diligent.
That's true. The trial court did conduct some investigation.
But none of the 29
people. None of the ones who had already.
None. So every single one of those people, after this information comes out, might have been sitting around talking about the 10 times they watched this tape and so on and how guilty Oswald is, and no one would ever know.
Well, there was I have a slight factual correction. He did investigate some of the 29, those who had not yet been questioned.
Well, that's what
he
I mean. The others, what possible rationale is there not to investigate the others?
The only rationale that I can postulate is that he believed that if the questioning of the rest of the
meaning the trial court judge, I assume.
Right,
because it's
that's
the
correct.
Trial court judge who makes
if the trial call. Court judge questioned the rest of the veneer and the bailiff, if that evidence disclosed something that really indicated a substantial violation, I guess, then he would have hopefully gone back and done more investigation. I think it's important.
But I don't understand your answer at all. So the trial judge thinks if further inquiry into the people who had already been evaluated, you know, who'd already been seated, would have disclosed the problem, then he would have had to do more investigation and he was feeling tired that day?
They've been going for a long time.
People have a right to a fair and unbiased jury. Maybe they would have had to go even longer in a high profile.
Could the judge have transferred the venue of the case even without a request?
No. He did raise that issue.
The defendant didn't request it.
That's right.
That's odd. Yeah, that was caught by the... Now, this fellow Klitschko was a member of the jury? Was he struck or what?
I believe he was struck, but I'm not sure.
Well, this was kind of wild when he said he learned a great deal. He says, I know I've learned more in the last 3 days sitting down there in that room about this case than I have since the day it happened. Now, that's sort of wild stuff, isn't it? So, and I take it there was no follow-up by the judge?
There was some follow-up on Mr.
Klitschko. There was?
Yes.
What was it?
He did ask him what he was talking about, and he was indicating that there were conversations amongst the veneer in the assembly room. The prosecutor objected to some of the questions which were sustained, so it was not as full as it might have been. But
I don't understand you. What inquiry did the judge make of Klitschko? Because what is quoted by your opponent is the judge saying to Klitschko, you know, it's a waste of time to have a trial at all, and Klitschko said yes. Now, was there something after that with the trial? I mean, what usually happens in these cases, the judge says, well, you know, are you able to set aside your feelings about the case and decide on the basis of the evidence? That's the standard routine. Did he do that with Klitschko?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't find it.
It's kind of important, though, isn't it? I mean, that's the elementary
response
of a judge to a jury. He actually says he doesn't think there ought to be a trial because he's made up his mind. The guy is clearly guilty.
Except Klitschko. I'm sure Klitschko did not sit, so...
Klitschko was struck with a peremptory. He's one of the ones who should have been struck for cause, clearly, because of his failure ever to say what Judge Posner is talking about. But once the judge has heard what Klitschko has to say, and once that gets corroborated by other people who are sitting down there in that jury room, I get back to this point that it's in light of Supreme Court decisions like Irwin against Dowd or other cases, it's almost inconceivable that he wouldn't have gone back and checked that the members of the denier who'd already been approved hadn't similarly been exposed to that kind of conversation.
He did ask the jurors who had yet to be questioned and the bailiff were present.
I know
at the
that,
room.
But why does that make it any better if suppose 10 people have already been sat in the jury? We don't know about those 10 people. We know nothing. Maybe they had exactly the same view Klitschko had.
Well, many of the jurors did, but of course the...
Well, why does that make me feel better?
What Mr. Oswald's defense was that he was present and he did participate in the crimes, and that's the
impression. Well, that, of course, is not a defense.
I'm sorry?
That is not a defense.
His defense was coercion.
Right.
So he didn't contest that.
Well, right, but there's nothing in this record. You make this argument in your brief that he really wanted a biased jury, and that's simply not true. His lawyers were objecting throughout, trying to get, the lawyers were doing, as far as I can tell, what they could under the circumstances, and he wanted a jury that would be open-minded enough to entertain his coercion defense, which is a legal defense.
That's correct. He wasn't necessarily concerned about jurors who had seen the videotape and who believed that Ted Oswald had participated in the shootout.
I'm not sure. I think you're really shaving this for
you. Well, Klitschko, though, represents the jury discussion as having concluded that Oswald was guilty.
And I'm not... He did say that.
So there's some evidence that other jurors who were not struck with peremptory challenges or anything else had made up their minds on the basis of their discussions before the trial began.
I believe that what they'd made up their mind about was the fact that
there's no basis for that. Look, Klitschko wouldn't think a trial a waste of time if he thought that Oswald might have a defense, even if Oswald was a participant in the crime. So he must have thought it was just, open and shut.
I'm not sure how much the jurors understood about coercion admitting his participation but raising this other...
Well, that doesn't help you either, right?
Well...
If they sit around, they don't understand coercion, they decide, why are we having a trial since this guy obviously did it? How does that enable him to put on a coercion defense?
If by saying this guy obviously did it, they mean that he participated.
Well, of course, because that's why Klitschko says the trial would be a waste of time. He doesn't know there's a defense of any sort, or they've discussed that. They said nonsense. They saw it all on the tape. There's nothing more to why have a trial. The judge could at least have said to these people, look, yes, he saw it on the tapes. Oswald doesn't deny his presence and he participated in the crime, but he's going to argue that he was forced to do it. Then you ask the jurors, and is that an argument that, you would consider, and you decide that strictly on the basis of the evidence presented at the trial, not on what you may have discussed in the jury room or anything like that. If he'd done that, that probably would have taken care of it.
I certainly agree, and certainly that would have been the more.
And there wasn't any reason for him not to do it, so it seems like gratuitous misconduct.
But could the judge have asked a question like that without the defense asking that? In other words, the judge telling the jurors that he admits he was there and he participated, but he has a different defense.
Well, but in the general voir dire, the defense attorney did make some slight reference to coercion, but of course the trial hadn't started, so the defense hadn't totally disclosed.
I mean, obviously you can't argue coercion without conceding your presence, right? That
right.
It would be ridiculous, right? So if coercion is going to be his defense, then his participation in the crime is the common premise of the whole trial.
Correct. Correct. But whether under the judge may have been able to make some reference to coercion since the defense had. I'm not sure he could lay out the elements such as they would appear in the jury instruction.
You say he didn't or he couldn't or what?
He didn't. The defense had made some reference to it.
Okay, well, thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. Budin?
And please, the court. My name is Jerome Buting, and I represent Ted Oswald, the appellee in this case.
Well, why don't we just start off with where we were with
sure.
Other counsel here. This is a notorious case, a lot of publicity. Everybody has some fair idea, all these jurors have some fair idea about what happened here. When these jurors are talking about the case, which probably shouldn't have been doing, but they are, and they're saying, a couple of them are saying he's guilty. I think he's guilty. Doesn't that really mean what they're saying is, they're anticipating he's going to say I was in Philadelphia or something. I wasn't in Waukesha committing these offenses. They don't know anything about sophisticated offenses like coercion or anything of that nature, do they?
Probably not, unless they read some newspaper articles ahead of time that did discuss that. But the point is not just that they're sitting around saying he's guilty. They're also saying trial's a joke, a sham, and a waste of time.
First of all, on the guilty thing, didn't they? I thought there was some dispute as whether they said he was involved or whether he was guilty.
Well, some of the jurors said, Klitschko clearly said, and Beard, the juror that was questioned right after Klitschko, both said those jurors, are saying he's guilty.
But nobody who made it on the jury said that. It was only this one fellow, and he said, Melky or whatever.
Actually,
said involved, right?
Actually, Schwinke's comment to the court in the court's presence was that he had a hard time believing he wasn't involved. But his statements outside the presence of the court were that he believed he was guilty and the trial was a waste of time, as several other jurors said. Juror Beers did, in fact, end up on the panel. As did obviously 11 others, that we don't know whether they were saying the same things that Schwinke was saying in the jury room or whether they were affected by it.
Yeah, but my problem here is when they're saying the trial is a waste of time or something like that, or it's a joke, don't you think that they're thinking that there's more of a defense that you weren't there, you have an alibi or something like that, and they were on videotape?
Well, always.
Where is the evidence? Any of these jurors were talking about, he's going to claim that he was coerced by his father, and that's a joke. We don't have to waste time.
Well, part of the problem is we don't know exactly what they were saying because the court, not only did the court not investigate, go back and re-question those jurors who had previously been qualified, he cut off, refused to allow Klitschko in answer directly to the defense counsel's question. First question was, well, Mr. Klitschko, please tell me what it is you're hearing down there that they're saying. And he said, no, I'm not going to tell you. That was the juror's response. And the judge didn't follow up on that and say, sir, you need to tell us what it is that's being said. He totally ignored that. So that part of it, we don't know exactly what was being said and how they were saying it. What we do know is that the only time that I can recall where the judge even discussed the possibility of a coercion defense with a juror, that was with one of the jurors that we challenged, Juror Weidler. She said, well, I frankly have a hard time with that. I don't feel that way. I think you always have choices. I don't think you can be coerced.
One of the things that's strange about this, I find unbelievable that there could be a coercion defense on these facts.
Well,
seems to me ridiculous. I mean, suppose you pointed a gun at your co-counsel and told her, look, I'm going to shoot you if you don't shoot Mr. Weinstein. So she goes ahead and kills Weinstein. You really think that she would have a coercion defense? that you're allowed to say, well, better he should die than I? I don't think that's the law.
Well, the court under Wisconsin believed that there was sufficient to...
Did the state argue against giving a coercion instruction?
Initially they did, and then they withdrew the objection, and they...
That's amazing.
They agreed that there was sufficient evidence...
The jurors are probably right.
Well, the real problem that I have with it is that the jurors that listened to the evidence were not impartial and therefore couldn't adequately consider all of the evidence. And there was evidence that talked about this young man's brainwashing from age 7 on in numerous ways, psychological ways, about how he had been trained and shaped into this mindset that his father had. And so there was evidence that would justify a psychological coercion defense. Whether the jury would accept it or not, obviously, would be anyone's question, but there's no way they were going to accept it if they came into it believing that the whole trial was a waste of time and a sham. And really, the belief in the participation of the offense or the involvement in the offense, there's nothing unique about that or not contesting that part of it. That's any affirmative defense, self-defense, defense of others, battered women's syndrome, something like that. In each of those cases, there's not a direct, you're not directly contesting whether you were involved, but there's a legal privilege, a legal defense to that. And what the Court of Appeals did in this case, which is very unconventional, very outside the bounds of normal legal reasoning, is to say that somehow that doesn't matter in this case, that the defendant was disenfranchised from the presumption of innocence and the burden of proof simply because he was raising the coercion defense.
Well, he had the burden of proof on the defense, didn't he?
No, he had the burden of persuasion. Under Wisconsin law, State versus Mose, the state...
Well, that's the major burden, of course. Burden of
persuasion. I'm sorry, not persuasion, but burden of production. I stand corrected. He had the burden to produce enough evidence to warrant the defense being presented to the jury, but once he did, under Wisconsin law, State uh-huh. versus Mose, the state had to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt...
His defense?
His defense, yes.
Is that true of insanity?
Actually, no. Insanity, it's a different burden completely because it's a separate phase under Wisconsin law.
Right.
But that is not true with regard to this defense. So the Court of Appeals really, I think their decision is very unusual, very objectively unreasonable to the point where they would carve out some exception in this case and say that it didn't matter that jurors felt the trial was a waste of time. Actually, they didn't even discuss that part of it.
How important is Schwenke's eventual service on the jury? Because I'm trying to figure out which parts of this case, let's say, are less contested or more contested. Because the problem with your argument with respect to Schwenke is that it rests so much on Ms. Mims' testimony, and at least some of the Wisconsin courts at some of the time were choosing not to credit her statement.
Well, first of all, if Schwenke was biased and he sat on the jury, then it's a do-over under United States Supreme Court law. I mean, Parker versus
right.
Gladden.
Yes,
that,
we knew that
clear.
For sure. If we knew right. a biased juror sat and somehow had the evidence.
Right. So to that extent, it's very important. The what we really don't know, what we can do is when we look at the Court of Appeals decision, they assumed, for the purposes of their fact-finding, that Juror Mim was telling the truth. And, in fact, it wasn't just Juror Mim, by the way. It was other jurors who also corroborated these kinds of statements were being made, and they used the same...
By Schwenke, or just generally?
Generally. They didn't identify Schwenke in particular because the investigation was cut off, but they used the same kinds of terms which are revealing. Those terms, waste of time, the trial's a waste of time, and Mim herself, the way that she identified him was indirectly, really. She just described it as one of the gentlemen who spoke up in the jury room and complained about writing a letter to the judge and not being responded to. And indirectly, then the trial judge identified that person as being Schwenke. So there's, I don't think there's any real credible dispute that Schwinkie is the one that was making those comments. But the other problem we have is that the trial court's failure to investigate the other jurors, failure to allow re-questioning of the other jurors, is that we don't know, we don't know how many others may also have had the very same opinion. And without delving into their deliberative process, and their, which is prohibited, we will never know exactly how much discussion occurred amongst those who ultimately were on the jury, going back in each day saying, what a waste of time. Can you believe this trial is still going on? You know, that's the problem, and that's why the Supreme Court has said that the time to, that you have to be vigilant about these and watchful for these sorts of prejudicial occurrences and determine their effect when they occur, and that the proper time for that is voir dire, when it would have been very simple to simply call back the other 25, say, have you been hearing these comments? Have they been affecting you? Can you put them aside? Can you still be fair and impartial? And those who couldn't, and by the way, there is evidence in the record that at least two jurors were affected by comments that were being made in the jury room. First, Klitschka, who said he came into the process with no opinion, and after sitting down there for 4 days, had changed his mind and believed that this, he was guilty and the trial was a waste of time. And also, there was another juror.
Oh, Mr. Weinstein said he was struck.
He was ultimately struck. But my point is...
So he didn't deliberate on us.
Yeah, but my point is there is evidence that at least some of those jurors, and you know, thankfully he was questioned. He was the only one who was there who was questioned other than Beers. So if
and you said Beers did sit.
Beers did sit.
Yeah. Which one, I'm drawing a blank on which person it was who was expressing. Was it Schwenke who said he wasn't sure that he wanted to sit anyway because he was concerned about his business and he might just vote to end the case without paying any attention to the evidence?
Actually, there were two that said that. Schwenke was one of them, yes. He said that later in a letter. He didn't say any of that to the court during...
No, we know he said that without regard to Mim's testimony.
That's correct. And I should correct the record. Defense counsel did move to strike him for cause after that letter came out. He asked the court to call him back and say, look, this is a juror who's saying, I might just vote to end this. And I'm just going to be too concerned about these things. You need to call him back and question him further or remove him now.
So there is actually motion at that stage to strike him for cause. All the peremptories are used up at this point, right?
That's correct. Well, they were about to be used up. This was just before that.
Okay.
And he even told the court, look, I'm telling you right now, I'm going to use all my peremptories on these other jurors that should have been struck for cause. Now we have another one who's saying he can't even, he's going to just decide to, just to end it.
You didn't move to change the venue here, and as I understand it, probably a very good decision that you thought you would find some sympathetic jurors here because there's been a lot of publicity about the effect the father had on the son prior to this incident. So if you make a conscious decision not to change venue, you're going to naturally have a lot of jurors who are going to know a lot about a notorious case like this. So if you've taken that chance, how...
Well, first of all, just so the court's clear, I wasn't the trial attorney.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't make that decision. And frankly, I challenged it initially and disagreed with it. But counsel raised...
It was a strategic decision
yep.
by the attorney that he'd find a more favorable jury pool. He wanted only one juror, at least, that would see it his way.
But that's no different than any litigant, any attorney who's trying in the selection process to find jurors who are at least open to their side and reasonable, would reasonably consider their defense. He did not. Despite the fact he didn't change venue, the record's clear that he did not want these jurors who had made up their minds that he was guilty or that the trial was a waste of time. He vigorously challenged each one of those jurors, moved them to be stricken for cause, and seven of them...
And he wanted jurors biased in his client's favor.
Well, as much so as I guess any litigant would
prefer
that.
Someone who would accept your Manchurian candidate defense.
I suppose, as much so as anybody, and as much as the state wanted anybody also favorable for their defense. The problem is that when you deal with a case with this much publicity, it required a careful voir dire, a cautious voir dire, a judge who would followed the United States Supreme Court's instructions that, particularly in high publicity cases like Irvin versus Dowd, where there was equally 80% of the jurors in this case came into that court believing he was guilty. And of the final 12, 8 of them had expressed that in their questionnaires, that they believed he was guilty before they ever came to court. When you have that kind of, not just knowledge, but opinion infecting the jury, you've got to be very careful to weed out those who can't set them aside. That's all that we have to do. They have to be able to say affirmatively.
Was coercion the only defense that Oswald presented to the jury?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Boudin. And
thank
Mr.
You.
Weinstein, your time expired, but you can have a minute just if you want to rebut.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the main point from my point of view is whether or not the Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals in Wisconsin, could have reasonably found that the judge did an adequate investigation of this case. It's not whether or not on direct appeal he should have done more, whether this court would reverse it if it came up on direct review in this court, and whether or not the investigation that he did do, which developed some evidence of what was going on in the jury room, was sufficient under the circumstances of this case, given that Mr. Oswald didn't contest his presence or participation in the crime.
Okay, thank you very much, both counsel. Next case.